Who, however, are these others with thee who seek admittance, Sir Knight? Enderig demanded. I will not cause the gates to open for foreign strangers. Mandarallan straightened in his saddle. Behold, he announced in a voice that could probably be heard all over the city, I bring you honor beyond measure. Fling wide the palace gates and prepare one and all to make obeisance. You look upon the holy face of Belgarath the sorcerer, the eternal man, and upon the divine countenance of his daughter, the Lady Palgara, who have come to Vomimbre to consult with the King of Arendia on diverse matters.
Isn't that a little overdone?
Geryon whispered to Aunt Paul.
It's customary, dear, she replied placidly. When you are dealing with errands, you have to be a little extravagant to get their attention.
And who hath told thee that this is the Lord Belgarath? Enderig asked with the faintest hint of a sneer. I will bend no knee before an unproved vagabond. Dost thou question my word, Sir Knight? Mandarallan returned, in an ominously quiet voice. And wilt thou then come down and put thy doubt to the test? Or is it perhaps that thou wouldst prefer to cringe dog-like behind a parapet and yap at thy betters?
Oh, that was very good, Beric said admiringly.
Mandarallan grinned tightly at the big man.
I don't think we're getting anywhere with this, Wolf muttered. It looks like I'll have to prove something to the skeptics if we're ever going to get into Secrodulan.
He slid down from his saddle and thoughtfully removed a twig from his horse's tail, picked up somewhere during their journeys. Then he strode to the center of the plaza and stood there in his gleaming white robe.
Sir Knight, he called up mildly to Enderig, you are a cautious man, I see. That is a good quality, but it can be carried too far.
I am hardly a child, old man, the dark-haired knight replied, in a tone hovering on the verge of insult. And I believe only what mine own eye hath confirmed.
It must be a sad thing to believe so little, Wolf observed.
He bent then, and inserted the twig he had been holding between two of the broad granite flagstones at his feet. He stepped back a pace and stretched his hand out above the twig, his face curiously gentle.
I'm going to do you a favor, Sir Enderig. I am going to restore your faith. Watch closely.
And then he spoke a single soft word that Geryon could not quite hear, but which set off the now familiar surge and a faint roaring sound. At first, nothing seemed to be happening. Then the two flagstones began to buckle upward with a grinding sound as the twig grew visibly thicker and began to reach up toward Mr. Wolf's outstretched hand. There were gasps from the palace walls as branches began to sprout from the twig, and it continued growing. Wolf raised his hand higher, and the twig obediently grew at his gesture, its branches broadening. By now it was a young tree and still growing. One of the flagstones cracked with a sharp report. There was absolute silence as every eye fixed in awed fascination on the tree. Mr. Wolf held out both hands and turned them until the palms were up. He spoke again, and the tips of the branches swelled and began to bud. Then the tree burst into flower, its blossoms a delicate pink and white.
Apple, wouldn't you say, Paul?
Wolf asked over his shoulder.
It appears to be, Father, she replied.
He patted the tree fondly, and then turned back to the dark-haired knight who had sunk, white-faced and trembling, to his knees.
Well, Sir Enderig, what do you believe now?
Please, forgive me, holy Belgarath, Enderig begged in a strangled voice.
Mr. Wolf drew himself up and spoke sternly. his words slipping into the measured cadences of the membrate idiom as easily as Aunt Paul's had earlier.
"I charge thee, Sir Knight, to care for this tree. It has grown here to renew thy faith and trust. Thy debt to it must be paid with tender and loving attention to its needs. In time it will bear fruit, and thou wilt gather the fruit and give it freely to any who ask it of thee. For thy soul's sake thou wilt refuse none, no matter how humble. As the tree gives freely, so shalt thou."
"Oh, that's a nice touch,"
Aunt Paul approved. Wolf winked at her.
"I will do even as thou hast commanded me, holy Belgareth,"
Sir Andrig choked.
"I pledge my heart to it."
Mr. Wolf returned to his horse.
"At least he'll do one useful thing in his life," he muttered.
After that, there was no further discussion. The palace gate creaked open, and they all rode into the inner courtyard and dismounted. Mundralen led them past kneeling and even sobbing nobles, who reached out to touch Mr. Wolf's robe as he passed. At Mandoralan's heels, they walked through the broad, tapestried hallways with a growing throng behind them. The door to the throne room opened, and they entered. The Arendish throne room was a great vaulted hall with sculptured buttresses soaring upward along the walls. Tall, narrow windows rose between the buttresses, and the light streaming through their stained glass panels was jeweled. The floor was polished marble, and on the carpeted stone platform at the far end stood the double throne of Arendia, backed by heavy purple drapes. Flanking the draped wall hung the massive antique weapons of 20 generations of Arendish royalty, lances, maces, and huge swords, taller than any man, hung among the tattered war banners of forgotten kings. Coradunan of Arendia was a sickly-looking young man in a gold-embroidered purple robe, and he wore his large gold crown as if it were too heavy for him. Beside him on the double throne sat his pale, beautiful queen. Together they watched somewhat apprehensively as the throng surrounding Mr. Wolf approached the wide steps leading up to the throne. Mandoralan announced,
"My king," dropping to one knee, "I bring into thy presence holy Belgarath, disciple of Aldur, and the staff upon which the kingdoms of the West has leaned since time began."
"He knows who I am, Mandoralan,"
Wolf said. He stepped forward and bowed briefly.
"Hail, Coradulan, and Maya Serena."
He greeted the king and queen.
"I'm sorry we have not had the chance to get acquainted before."
The young king replied in a voice whose rich timbre belied his frail appearance.
"The honor is ours, noble Belgarath."
"My father spoke often of thee," the queen said.
"We were good friends," Wolf told her. "Allow me to present my daughter, Palgura."
"Great lady,"
the king responded, with a respectful inclination of his head.
"All the world knows of thy power, but men have forgotten to speak of thy beauty."
"Oh, we'll get along well together,"
Aunt Paul answered warmly, smiling at him.
"My heart trembles at the sight of the flower of our womanhood,"
the queen declared. Aunt Paul looked at the queen thoughtfully.
"We must talk, Maya Serena," she said in a serious tone, "in private, and very soon."
The queen looked startled. Mr. Wolf introduced the rest of them, and each bowed in turn to the young king. Coradunan said,
"Welcome, gentle Zarl. My poor court is overwhelmed by so noble a company."
"We don't have much time to waste, Coradunan,"
Mr. Wolf told him.
"The courtesy of the Arendish throne is the marvel of the world. I don't want to offend you and your lovely queen by cutting short those stately observances which so ornament your court. But I have certain news which I have to present to you in private. The matter is of extreme urgency."
"Then I am at thine immediate disposal," the king replied, rising from his throne.
"Forgive us, dear friends,"
he said to the assembled nobles,
"but this ancient friend of our kingly line has information
which must be imparted to our ears alone with utmost urgency. I pray thee, let us go apart for a little space of time to receive this instruction. We shall return presently.
Bogra, Mr. Wolfe said.
Oh, go ahead, father, she replied.
Just now I have to speak with Maya Serena about something that is very important to her.
Can't it wait?
No, father, it cannot.
And with that she took the Queen's arm and the two left. Mr. Wolfe stared after her for a moment, then shrugged, and he and Cora Doolan also left the throne room. An almost shock silence followed their departure.
Most unseemly,
an old courtier with wispy white hair disapproved.
Unnecessary haste, my lord, Mandor Allan informed him. As the revered Belgareth has intimated, our mission is the hinge-pin of the survival of all of the kingdoms of the West. Our ancient foe may soon be abroad again. It will not be long, I fear, ere the Membrite knights will again stand the brunt of titanic war.
Blessed, then, be the tongue which brings the news, the white-haired old man declared. I had feared that I had seen my last battle, and would die abed in my dotage. I thank great Caldan that I still have my vigor, and that my prowess is undiminished by the passage of a mere 40 years.
Geryon drew off by himself to one side of the room to wrestle with a problem. Events had swept him into King Coradulan's court before he had had the time to prepare himself for an unpleasant duty. He had given his word to Lodoran to bring certain things to the king's attention, but he did not have the faintest idea how to begin. The exaggerated formality of the Arundish court intimidated him. This was not at all like the rough, good-natured court of King Unheg and Val Alhorn, or the almost homey court of King Folrak and Sindar. This was Vomimbre, and the prospect of blurting out news of the wild scheme of a group of Astorian firebrands, as he had blurted out the news of the Earl Jarvik and Kerak, now seemed utterly out of the question. Suddenly, the thought of that previous event struck him forcibly. The situation then was so similar to this one that it seemed all at once like some elaborate game. The moves on the board were almost identical, and in each case he had been placed in the uncomfortable position of being required to block that last crucial move, where a king would die and a kingdom would collapse. He felt oddly powerless, as if his entire life were in the fingers of two faceless players, maneuvering pieces in the same patterns on some vast board, in a game that, for all he knew, had lasted for eternity. There was no question about what had to be done. The players, however, seemed content to leave it up to him to come up with a way to do it. King Coradulan appeared shaken when he returned to the throne room with Mr. Wolfe a half-hour later, and he controlled his expression with obvious difficulty.
"Forgive me, gentles all," he apologized, "but I have had disturbing news. For the present time, however, let us put aside our cares and celebrate this historic visit. Summon musicians and command that a banquet be made ready."
There was a stir near the door, and a black-robed man entered with half a dozen Membrate knights in full armor following him closely, their eyes narrow with suspicion and their hands on their sword hilts, as if daring anyone to bar their leader's path. As the robed man strode nearer, Geryon saw his angular eyes and scarred cheeks. The man was a Murgo. Barak put a firm hand on Hedhar's arm. The Murgo had obviously dressed in haste, and he seemed slightly breathless from his hurried trip to the throne room.
"Your Majesty,"
he rasped, bowing deeply to Coradulan.
"I have just been advised that visitors have arrived at thy court, and have made haste here to greet them in the name of my king, Tawar Urgas."
Coradulan's face grew cold.
"I do not recall summoning thee, Nachak."
"It is then as I had feared," the Murgo replied. "These messengers have spoken ill of my race. seeking to dissever the friendship which doth exist between the thrones of Arindia and of Cthulmurgos. I am chagrined to find that thou hast given ear to slanders without offering me opportunity to reply. Is this just, August Majesty?
Who is this?
Mr. Wolf asked Coradulan.
Nachak, the king replied, the ambassador of Cthulmurgos. Shall I introduce thee to him, ancient one?
That won't be necessary,
Mr. Wolf answered bleakly.
Every Murgle alive knows who I am. Mothers in Cthulmurgos frighten their children into obedience by mentioning my name.
But I am not a child, old man,
Nechek sneered.
I am not afraid of you.
That could be a serious failing,
Sulk observed. The Murgos name had struck Garion almost like a blow. As he looked at the scarred face of the man who had so misled Lothlórien and his friends, he realized that the players had once again moved their pieces into that last crucial position, and that who would win, and who would lose, once again depended entirely on him.
What lies have you told the king?
Nechek was demanding of Mr. Wolf.
No lies, Nechek. Just the truth. That should be enough.
I protest, your majesty,
Nechek appealed to the king.
I protest in the strongest manner possible. All the world knows of his hatred for my people. How can you allow him to poison your mind against us?
Silk commented slyly.
He forgot the thees and thous that time.
He's excited, Barak replied. Murgos get clumsy when they are excited. It is one of their shortcomings.
Aeons,
Nechek spat.
That's right, Murgo,
Barak said coldly. He was still holding Hetar's arm. Nechek looked at them, and then his eyes widened as he seemed to see Hetar for the first time. He recoiled from the Algar's hate-filled stare, and his half-dozen knights closed protectively around him.
Your Majesty,
he rasped,
I know that man to be Hetar of Algaria, a known murderer. I demand that you arrest him.
Demand, Nechek?
The king asked with a dangerous glint in his eyes.
Thou wilt present demands to me in my own court?
Forgive me, your majesty,
Nechek apologized quickly.
The sight of that animal so disturbed me that I forgot myself.
You would be wise to leave now,
Nechek, Mr. Wolf recommended.
It's not really a good idea for a Murgo to be alone in the presence of so many Aeons. Accidents have a way of happening under such conditions.
Grandfather?
Garion said urgently. Without knowing exactly why, he knew that it was time to speak. Nechek must not be allowed to leave the throne room. The faceless players had made their final moves, and the game must end here.
Grandfather, there is something I have to tell you.
Not now, Garion.
Wolf was still looking with hard eyes at the Murgo.
It is important, Grandfather. Very important?
Mr. Wolf turned as if to reply sharply, but then he seemed to see something. Something that no one else in the throne room could see, and his eyes widened in momentary amazement.
All right, Garion,
he said in a strangely quiet voice.
Go ahead.
Some men are planning to kill the king of Arindia. Nechak's one of them.
Garion had said it louder than he had intended, and a sudden silence fell over the throne room at his words. Nechek's face went pale, and his hand moved involuntarily toward his sword hilt, then froze. Garion was suddenly keenly aware of Barak's hulking form just behind him, and Hetar, grim as death in black leather, towering beside him. Nechek stepped back and made a quick gesture to his steel-clad knights. Quickly they formed a protective ring around him, their hands on their weapons.
"I won't stay and listen to such slander,"
the Murgo declared. Khoradulin informed him coolly.
"I have not yet given thee my permission to withdraw, Nechak. I require thy presence yet a while."
The king's young face was stern, and his eyes bored into the Murgo's. Then he turned to Geryon.
"I would hear more of this. Speak truthfully, lad, and fear not reprisal from any man for thy words."
Geryon drew a deep breath and spoke carefully.
"I don't really know all of the details, Your Majesty. I found out about it quite by accident," he explained.
"Say what thou canst," the king told him.
"As nearly as I can tell, Your Majesty, next summer, when you travel to Voaster, a group of men are going to try to kill you somewhere on the highway."
"Istarian traitors, doubtless,"
a gray-haired courtier suggested.
"They call themselves patriots,"
Geryon answered.
"Inevitably,"
the courtier sneered. The king said,
"Such attempts are not uncommon. We will take steps to guard against them. I thank thee for this information." "There's more, Your Majesty. When they attack, they are going to be wearing the uniforms of Tol'Nedrin legionnaires."
Silk whistled sharply.
"The whole idea is to make your nobles believe that you've been killed by Tol'Nedrins. These men assure that Mimbre will immediately declare war on the Empire, and that as soon as that happens, the legions will march in. Then, when everybody here is involved in the war, they are going to announce that Astoria is no longer subject to the Arendish throne. They are sure that the rest of Astoria will follow them at that point."
"I see," the king replied thoughtfully.
"'Tis a well-conceived plan, but with a subtlety uncharacteristic of our wild-eyed Astorian brothers. But I have yet heard nothing linking the emissary of Tower Urgas with this treason."
"The whole plan was his, Your Majesty. He gave them all of the details and the gold to buy the Tol'Nedrin uniforms and to encourage the other people to join them."
"He lies!"
Nechak burst out.
"Thou shalt have opportunity to reply, Nechak,"
the king advised him. He turned back to Geryon.
"Let us pursue this matter further. How camest thou by this knowledge?"
"I cannot say, Your Majesty,"
Geryon replied painfully.
"I gave my word not to. One of the men told me about it to prove that he was my friend. He put his life in my hands, to show how much he trusted me. I cannot betray him."
"The loyalty speaks well of thee, young Geryon. But thine accusation against the Murgo ambassador is most grave. Without violating thy trust, canst thou provide corroboration?"
Helplessly, Geryon shook his head.
"This is a serious matter, Your Majesty,"
Nechak declared.
"I am the personal representative of Tower Urgas. This lying urchin is Belgareth's creature. His wild, unsubstantiated story is an obvious attempt to discredit me, and to drive a wedge between the thrones of Arindia and Tolmogos. This accusation must not be allowed to stand. The boy must be forced to identify these imaginary plotters, or to admit that he lies."
"He has given his pledge, Nechak,"
the king pointed out.
"He says so, Your Majesty,"
Nechak replied with a sneer.
"Let us put him to the test. An hour on the rack may persuade him to speak freely."
"I have seldom had much faith in confessions obtained by torment,"
Khoradulin replied.
"If it please Your Majesty,"
Mandaralan interjected,
"it may be that I can help to resolve this matter."
Geryon threw a stricken look at the knight. Mandaralan knew Leldoran, and it would be a simple thing for him to guess the truth. Mandaralan, moreover, was a Mimbret, and Khoradulin was his king. Not only was he under no compulsion to remain silent, but his duty almost obliged him to speak.
"Sir Mandaralan,"
the king responded gravely,
Thy devotion to truth and duty are legendary. Canst thou, perchance, identify these plotters? The question hung there.
Nay, sire, Mandurallan replied firmly. But I know Geryon to be a truthful and honest boy. I will vouch for him.
That is scanty corroboration. I declare that he lies. So where does that leave us?
The lad is my companion, Mandurallan said. I will not be the instrument of breaking his pledge, since his honor is as dear to me as mine own. By our law, however, a cause incapable of proof may be decided by trial at arms. I will champion this boy. I declare before this company that this Nechak is a foul villain, who hath joined with divers others to slay my king.
He pulled off his steel gauntlet and tossed it to the floor. The crash, as it struck the polished stone, seemed thunderous.
Take up my gage, Murgo, Mandurallan said coldly, or let one of thy sycophant knights take it up for thee. I will prove thy villainy upon thy body, or upon the body of thy champion.
Nechak stared first at the mailed gauntlet, and then at the great knight standing accusingly before him. He licked his lips nervously, and looked around the throne room. Except for Mandurallan, none of the Mimbrate nobles present were under arms. The Murgo's eyes narrowed with a sudden desperation.
Kill him!
He snarled at the six men in armor surrounding him. The knights looked shocked and doubtful.
Kill him, Nechak commanded them. 1,000 gold pieces to the man who spills out his life.
The faces of the six knights went flat at those words. As one man, they drew their swords and spread out, moving with raised shields toward Mandurallan. There were gasps and cries of alarm as the nobles and their ladies scrambled out of the way.
What treason is this? Mandurallan demanded of them. Are you so enamored of this Murgo and his gold that you would draw weapons in the king's presence in open defiance of the law's prohibitions? Put up your swords!
But they ignored his words and continued their grim advance.
Defend thyself, Sir Mandurallan, Corodulan urged, half rising from his throne. I free thee of the law's constraint.
Barak, however, had already begun to move. Noting that Mandurallan had not carried his shield into the throne room, the red-bearded man jerked an enormous two-handed broadsword down from the array of banners and weapons at one side of the dais.
Mandurallan!
He shouted, and with a great heave, he slid the huge blade skittering and bouncing across the stone floor toward the knight's feet. Mandurallan stopped the sliding weapon with one mailed foot, stooped, and picked it up. The approaching knights looked a bit less confident as Mandurallan lifted the six-foot blade with both hands. Barak, grinning hugely, drew his sword from one hip and his war axe from the other. Hetar, his drawn saber held low, was circling the clumsy knights on cat-like feet. Without thinking, Geryon reached for his own sword, but Mr. Wolf's hand closed on his wrist.
"You stay out of it,"
the old man told him, and pulled him clear of the impending fight. Mandurallan's first blow crashed against a quickly raised shield, shattering the arm of a knight with a crimson surcoat over his armor, and hurling him into a clattering heap 10 feet away. Barak parried a sword stroke from a burly knight with his axe, and battered at the man's raised shield with his own heavy sword. Hetar toyed expertly with a knight in green enameled armor, easily avoiding his opponent's awkward strokes and flicking the point of his saber at the man's visored face. The steely ring of sword on sword echoed through Khoradulin's throne room, and showers of sparks cascaded from the clash of edge against edge. With huge blows, Mandurallan smashed at a second man. A vast sweep of his two-handed sword went under the knight's shield, and the man shrieked as the great blade bit through his armor and into his side. Then he fell with blood spouting from the sheared-in gash that reached halfway through his body. Barak, with a deft backswing of his war axe, caved in the side of the burly knight's helmet, and the knight half-spun then fell to the floor. Hetar feinted a quick move, then drove his saber point through a slot in the green-armored knight's visor. The stricken knight stiffened as the saber ran into his brain. As the Malay surged across the polished floor, the nobles and ladies scurried this way and that to avoid being overrun by the struggling men. Necek watched with dismay as his knights were systematically destroyed before his eyes. Then, quite suddenly, he turned and fled.
"He's getting away!"
Geryon shouted, but Hetar was already in pursuit. His dreadful face and blood-smeared saber melting the courtiers and their screaming ladies out of his path as he ran to cut off Nechak's flight. The Murgo had almost reached the far end of the hall before Hetar's long strides carried him through the crowd to block the doorway. With a cry of despair, the ambassador yanked his sword from its scabbard, and Geryon felt a strange momentary pity for him. As the Murgo raised his sword, Hetar flicked his saber almost like a whip, lashing him once on each shoulder. Nechak desperately tried to raise his numbed arms to protect his head, but Hetar's blade dropped low instead. Then, with a peculiar fluid grace, the grim-faced Algar quite deliberately ran the Murgo through. Geryon saw the saber blade come out between Nechak's shoulders, angling sharply upward. The ambassador gasped, dropped his sword, and gripped Hetar's wrist with both hands. But the hawk-faced man inexorably turned his hand, twisting the sharp, curved blade inside the Murgo's body. Nechak groaned and shuddered horribly. Then his hands slipped off Hetar's wrists, and his legs buckled under him. With a gurgling sigh, he toppled backward, sliding limply off of Hetar's blade. Chapter 11. A moment of dreadful silence filled the throne room, following the death of Nechak. Then the two members of his bodyguard, who were still on their feet, threw their weapons down on the blood-spattered floor with a sudden clatter. Mandaralan raised his visor and turned toward the throne.
"Sire," he said respectfully, "the treachery of Nechak stands proved by reason of this trial at arms."
"Truly," the king agreed. "My only regret is that thine enthusiasm in pursuing this cause has deprived us of the opportunity to probe more deeply into the full extent of Nechak's duplicity."
"I expect that the plots he hatched will dry up once word of what happened here gets around," Mr. Wolfe observed.
Perhaps so," the king acknowledged. "I would have pursued the matter further, however. I would know if this villainy was Nechak's own, or if I must look beyond him to Tawaragos himself." He frowned thoughtfully, then shook his head as if to put a certain dark speculation aside. "Orindia stands in thy debt, ancient Belgarath. This brave company of thine has forestalled the renewal of a war best forgotten." He looked sadly at the blood-smeared floor and the bodies littering it. "My throne room has become as a battlefield. The curse of Orindia extends even here."
He sighed then.
"Have it cleansed,"
he ordered shortly, and turned his head so that he would not have to watch the grim business of cleaning up. The nobles and ladies began to buzz as the dead were removed, and the polished stone floor was quickly mopped to remove the pools of sticky blood.
"Good fight," Barak commented as he carefully wiped his axe blade. "I am in thy debt, Lord Barak," Mandaralan said gravely. "Thine aid was fortuitous," Barak shrugged. "It seems appropriate,"
Hetar rejoined them, his expression one of grim satisfaction.
"You did a nice job, Nechak," Barak complimented him.
"I have had a lot of practice," Hetar answered. "Murgos always seem to make that same mistake when they get into a fight. I think there's a gap in their training somewhere."
"That's a shame, isn't it?"
Barak suggested, with vast insincerity. Geryon moved away from them. Although he knew it was irrational, He nevertheless felt a keen sense of personal responsibility for the carnage he had just witnessed. The blood and violent death had come about as the result of his words. Had he not spoken, men who were now dead would still be alive. No matter how justified, how necessary, his speaking out had been, he still suffered the pangs of guilt. He did not at the moment trust himself to speak with his friends. More than anything, he wished that he could talk with Aunt Paul. But she had not yet returned to the throne room, and so he was left to wrestle alone with his wounded conscience. He reached one of the embrasures formed by the buttresses along the south wall of the throne room and stood alone in somber reflection until a girl, perhaps 2 years older than he, glided across the floor toward him, her stiff crimson brocade gown rustling. The girl's hair was dark, even black, and her skin was creamy. Her bodice was cut quite low, and Geryon found some difficulty in finding a safe place for his eyes as she bore down on him.
"I would add my thanks to the thanks of all Orindia, Lord Geryon,"
she breathed at him. Her voice was vibrant with all kinds of emotions, none of which Geryon understood.
"Thy timely revelation of the Murgos' plotting had in truth saved the life of our sovereign."
Geryon felt a certain warmth at that.
"I didn't do all that much, my lady,"
he replied with a somewhat insincere attempt at modesty.
"My friends did all of the fighting." "Oh, but it was thy brave denunciation which uncovered the foul plot,"
she persisted.
"And virgins will sing of the nobility with which thou hast protected the identity of thy nameless and misguided friend."
Virgin was not a word with which Geryon was prepared to deal. He blushed and floundered helplessly.
"Art thou in truth, noble Geryon, the grandson of eternal Belgarath?"
"The relationship's a bit more distant. We simplify it for the sake of convenience."
"But thou art in his direct line?"
she persisted, her violet eyes glowing.
"He tells me I am."
"Is the Lady Balgara perchance thy mother?"
"My aunt."
"Oh, a close kinship nonetheless,"
she approved warmly, her hand coming to rest lightly on his wrist.
"Thy blood, Lord Geryon, is the noblest in the world. Tell me, art thou perchance as yet unbetrothed?"
Geryon blinked at her, his ears growing suddenly redder.
"Ah, Geryon,"
Mandarellan boomed in his hearty voice, striding into the awkward moment.
"I had been seeking thee. Wilt thou excuse us, Countess?"
The young lady shot Mandarellan a look filled with sheer venom, but the knight's firm hand was already drawing Geryon away.
"We will speak again, Lord Geryon,"
she called after him.
"I hope so, milady,"
Geryon replied back over his shoulder. Then he and Mandarellan merged with the crowd of courtiers near the center of the throne room.
"I wanted to thank you, Mandarellan,"
Geryon said finally, struggling with it a little.
"For what, lad?"
"You knew whom I was protecting when I told the king about Natchek, didn't you?"
"Naturally,"
the knight replied in a rather offhand way.
"You could have told the king. Actually, it was your duty to tell him, wasn't it?"
"But thou hadst given thy pledge."
"You hadn't, though."
"Thou art my companion, lad. Thy pledge is as binding upon me as it is upon thee. Didst thou not know that?"
Geryon was startled by Mandarellan's words. The exquisite involvement of Erendish ethics were beyond his grasp.
"So you fought for me instead?"
Mandarellan laughed easily.
"Of course," he answered. "Though I must confess to thee in all honesty, Geryon, that my eagerness to stand as thy champion grew not entirely out of friendship. In truth, I found that Murgo Natchek offensive, and liked not the cold arrogance of his hirelings.
I was inclined toward battle before thy need of championing presented itself. Perhaps it is I who should thank thee for providing the opportunity.
I don't understand you at all, Mander Allen,
Garion admitted.
Sometimes I think you're the most complicated man I've ever met.
I? Mander Allen seemed amazed. I am the simplest of men.
He looked around then and leaned slightly toward Garion.
I must advise thee to have a care on thy speech with the Countess Vesrana. It was that which impelled me to draw thee aside.
Who?
The comely young lady with whom thou wert speaking. She considers herself the greatest beauty in the kingdom, and is seeking a husband worthy of her.
A husband?
Garion responded in a faltering voice.
Thou art fair game, lad. Thy blood is noble beyond measure by reason of thy kinship to Belgarath. Thou wouldst be a great prize for the Countess.
Husband?
Garion quavered again, his knees beginning to tremble.
Me?
I know not how things stand in Misty Sandaria,
Mander Allen declared.
But in Arendia, thou art of marriageable age. Guard well thy speech, lad. The most innocent remark can be viewed as a promise, should a noble choose to take it so.
Garion swallowed hard and looked around apprehensively. After that, he did his best to hide. His nerves, he felt, were not up to any more shocks. The Countess Vesrana, however, proved to be a skilled huntress. With appalling determination, she tracked him down and penned him in another embrasure with smoldering eyes and heaving bosom.
Now, perchance, we may continue our most interesting discussion, Lord Garion.
She purred at him. Garion was considering flight when Aunt Paul, accompanied by a now radiant Queen Maya Serena, re-entered the throne room. Mander Allen spoke briefly to her, and she immediately crossed to the spot where the violet-eyed countess held Garion captive.
"Garion, dear," she said as she approached, "it's time for your medicine."
"Medicine?" he replied, confused.
"Oh, a most forgetful boy," she told the countess. "Probably it was all of the excitement, but he knows that if he does not take the potion every 3 hours, the madness will return."
"Madness?"
the Countess Vesrana repeated sharply.
"Oh, it's the curse of his family," Aunt Paul sighed. "They all have it, all the male children. The potion works for a while, but of course it is only temporary. We'll have to find some patient and self-sacrificing lady soon, so that he can marry and father children before his poor brains begin to soften. After that, his poor wife will be doomed to spend the rest of her days caring for him."
She looked critically at the young countess.
"I wonder," she said, "could it be possible that you are as yet unbetrothed? You appear to be of suitable age."
She reached out and briefly took hold of Asrana's rounded arm.
"Nice and strong," she said approvingly. "I'll speak to my father, Lord Belgarath, about this immediately."
The countess began to back away, her eyes wide.
"Come back," Aunt Paul told her. "His fits won't start for several minutes yet."
The girl fled.
"Can't you ever stay out of trouble?"
Aunt Paul demanded of Garion, leading him firmly away.
But I didn't say anything," he objected.
Mander Allen joined them, grinning broadly.
"I perceive that thou hast routed our predatory countess, my lady. I should have thought that she would prove more persistent."
"I gave her something to worry about. It dampened her enthusiasm for matrimony."
"What matter didst thou discuss with our queen?"
he asked.
"I have not seen her smile so in years."
"Maya Serena has had a problem of a female nature. I do not think that you would understand."
"Her inability to carry a child to term?"
"Don't errands have anything better to do than gossip about things that do not concern them? Why don't you go find another fight instead of asking intimate questions?"
"The matter is of great concern to us all, my lady," Mandarallan apologized. If our queen does not produce an heir to the throne, we stand in danger of dynastic war. All Orindia could go up in flames.
There aren't going to be any flames, Mandarallan. Fortunately, I arrived in time, though it was very close. You will have a crown prince before winter.
Is it possible?
Would you like all of the details?
She asked pointedly.
I have noticed that men usually prefer not to know about the exact mechanics involved in childbearing.
Mandarallan's face slowly flushed. I will accept thine assurances, Lady Pulgara, he replied quickly.
I'm so glad.
I must inform the king, he declared.
You must mind your own business, Sir Mandarallan. The queen will tell Corradulan what he needs to know. Why don't you go clean off your armor? You look as if you just walked through a slaughterhouse.
He bowed, still blushing, and moved away.
Men, she said to his retreating back. Then she turned back to Geryon. I hear that you have been busy. I had to warn the king. You seem to have an absolute genius for getting mixed up in this sort of thing. Why didn't you tell me, or your grandfather? I promised that I wouldn't say anything. Geryon, she said firmly, under our present circumstances, secrets are very dangerous. You knew that what Leldoran told you was important, didn't you? I didn't say it was Leldoran.
She gave him a withering look.
Geryon, dear, she told him bluntly, don't ever make the mistake of thinking that I'm stupid. I didn't, he floundered. I gave them my word that I wouldn't tell anybody.
She sighed.
We have got to get you out of Orindia. The place seems to be affecting your good sense. The next time you feel the urge to make one of these startling public announcements, talk it over with me first, all right? Yes, ma'am, he mumbled, embarrassed. Oh, Geryon, what am I ever going to do with you?
And then she laughed fondly and put her arm about his shoulder, and everything was all right again. The evening passed uneventfully after that. The banquet was tedious, and the toasts afterward interminable, as each Orindish noble arose in turn to salute Mr. Wolfe and Aunt Paul with flowery and formal speeches. They went to bed late, and Geryon slept fitfully, troubled by nightmares of the hot-eyed countess pursuing him through endless flower-strewn corridors. They were up early the next morning, and, after breakfast, Aunt Paul and Mr. Wolfe spoke privately with the king and queen again. Geryon, still nervous about his encounter with the Countess Vesrana, stayed close to Mandarallan. The Membrate Knight seemed best equipped to help him avoid any more such adventures. They waited in an antechamber to the throne room, and Mandarallan in his blue surcoat explained at length an intricate tapestry which covered one entire wall. About mid-morning, Sir Andarig, the dark-haired knight Mr. Wolfe had ordered to spend his days caring for the tree in the plaza, came looking for Mandarallan.
"Sir Knight," he said respectfully, "the Baron of Voebo hath arrived from the north, accompanied by his lady. They have asked after thee and besought me that I should seek thee out for them."
"Thou art most kind, Sir Andarig," Mandarallan replied, rising quickly from the bench where he had been sitting. "Thy courtesy becomes thee greatly." Andarig sighed.
"Alas, that it was not always so. I have this past night stood vigil before that miraculous tree which Holy Belgarath commended to my care. I thus had leisure to consider my life in retrospect. I have not been an admirable man. Bitterly, I repent my faults, and will strive earnestly for amendment."
Wordlessly, Mandarallan clasped the knight's hand and then followed him down a long hallway to a room where the visitors waited. It was not until they entered the sunlit room that Geryon remembered that the wife of the Baron of Oebor was the lady to whom Mandarallan had spoken on that windswept hill beside the Great West Road some days before. The Baron was a solid-looking man in a green surcoat,
and his hair and beard were touched with white. His eyes were deep-set, and there seemed to be a great sadness in them.
"Mandoralan,"
he said, warmly embracing the younger knight.
"Thou art unkind to absent thyself from us for so long." "It is my duty, my lord,"
Mandoralan replied in a subdued voice.
"Come, Narina,"
the baron told his wife.
"Greet our friend."
The Baroness Narina was much younger than her husband. Her hair was dark and very long. She wore a rose-colored gown, and she was beautiful, though Geryon thought no more so than any of a half a dozen others he had seen at the Arendish court.
"Dear Mandoralan,"
she said, kissing the knight with a brief, chaste embrace.
"We have missed thee at Voebor."
"And the world is as desolate for me, that I must be absent from its well-loved halls."
Sir Andreg had bowed and then discreetly departed, leaving Geryon standing awkwardly near the door.
"And who is this likely-appearing lad who accompanies thee, my son?"
the baron asked.
"A Sundarian boy,"
Mandoralan responded.
"His name is Geryon. He and divers others have joined with me in a perilous quest. Joyfully, I greet my son's companion,"
the baron declared. Geryon bowed, but his mind raced, attempting to find some legitimate excuse to leave. The situation was terribly embarrassing, and he did not want to stay.
"I must wait upon the king," the baron announced. "Custom and courtesy demand that I present myself to him as soon as possible upon my arrival at his court. Wilt thou, Mandoralan, remain here with my baroness until I return?"
"I will, my lord."
"I'll take you to where the king is meeting with my aunt and my grandfather, sir,"
Geryon offered quickly.
"Nay, lad," the baron demurred, "thou too must remain. Though I have no cause for anxiety, knowing full well the fidelity of my wife and my dearest friend, idle tongues would make scandal were they left together unattended. Prudent folk leave no possible foundation for false rumor and vile innuendo."
"I'll stay then, sir,"
Geryon replied quickly.
"Good lad,"
the baron approved. Then, with eyes that seemed somehow haunted, he quietly left the room. Mandoralan asked Narina,
"Wilt thou sit, my lady?"
pointing to a sculptured bench near the window.
"I will," she said. "Our journey was fatiguing."
"It is a long way from Voebor,"
Mandoralan agreed, sitting on another bench.
"Didst thou and my lord find the roads passable?"
"Perhaps not yet so dry as to make travel enjoyable,"
she told him. They spoke at some length about roads and weather, sitting not far from each other but not so close that anyone chancing to pass by the open door could have mistaken their conversation for anything less than innocent. Their eyes, however, spoke more intimately. Geryon, painfully embarrassed, stood looking out a window, carefully choosing one that kept him in full view of the door. As the conversation progressed, there were increasingly long pauses, and Geryon cringed inwardly at each agonizing silence. Afraid that either Mandoralan or the Lady Narina might, in the extremity of their hopeless love, cross that unspoken boundary and blurt the one word, phrase, or sentence which would cause restraint and honor to crumble and turn their lives into disaster. And yet, a certain part of his mind wished that the word or phrase or sentence might be spoken, that their love could flame, however briefly. It was there, in that quiet, sunlit chamber, that Geryon passed a small crossroad. The prejudice against Mandoralan that Laldron's unthinking partisanship had instilled in him finally shattered and fell away. He felt a surge of feeling, not pity, for they would not have accepted pity, but compassion, rather. More than that, there was the faint beginning of an understanding of the honor and towering pride which, though utterly selfless, was the foundation of that tragedy which had existed in Arindia for uncounted centuries. For perhaps half an hour, Mandoran and the Lady Nerina sat, speaking hardly at all now, their eyes lost in each other, while Geryon, near to tears, stood his enforced watch over them. And then, Durnick came to tell them that Aunt Paul and Mr. Wolf were getting ready to leave. Part 2. Tolnedra. Chapter 12. A brassy chorus of horns saluted them from the battlements of Vomimbre as they rode out of the city, accompanied by 20 armored knights and by King Coradulan himself. Geryon glanced back once and thought he saw the Lady Nerina standing upon the wall above the arched gate, though he could not be sure. The lady did not wave, and Mandoralan did not look back. Geryon, however, very nearly held his breath until Vomimbre was out of sight. It was mid-afternoon by the time they reached the ford which crossed the river Arend into Tolnedra, and the bright sun sparkled on the river. The sky was very blue overhead, and the colored pennons on the lances of the escorting knights snapped in the breeze. Geryon felt a desperate urgency, an almost unbearable necessity to cross the river and leave Arindia and the terrible things that had happened there behind.
"Hail and farewell, holy Belgareth," Coradunan said at the water's edge. "I will, as thou hast advised me, begin my preparations. Arindia will be ready. I pledge my life to it."
"And I'll keep you advised of our progress from time to time," Mr. Wolf said.
"I will also examine the activities of the Murgos within my kingdom," Coradulan said. "If what thou hast told me should prove true, as I doubt not that it shall, then I will expel them from Arindia. I will seek them out, one and all, and hurry them out of the land. I will make their lives a burden and an affliction to them for sowing discord and contention among my subjects."
Wolf grinned at him. "That's an idea that appeals to me. Murgos are an arrogant people, and a little affliction now and then teaches them humility."
He reached out and took the king's hand.
"Goodbye, Coradulan. I hope the world's happier next time we meet."
"I will pray that it may be so," the young king said. Then Mr. Wolf led the way down into the rippling water of the shallow ford. Beyond the river, Imperial Tolnedra waited, and from the banks behind them, the Mimbrate knights saluted with a great fanfare on their horns. As they emerged on the far side of the river, Geryon looked around, trying to see some difference in terrain or foliage which might distinguish Arindia from Tolnedra, but there seemed to be none. The land, indifferent to human boundaries, flowed on unchanged. About a half mile from the river they entered the forest of Vordu, an extensive tract of well-kept woodland, which extended from the sea to the foothills of the mountains to the east. Once they were under the trees, they stopped and changed back into their traveling clothes.
"I think we might as well keep the guise of merchants," Mr. Wolf said, settling with obvious comfort back into his patched rust-colored tunic and mismatched shoes. "It won't fool the Grolems, of course, but it will satisfy the Tolnedrans we meet along the way. We can deal with the Grolems in other ways." "Are there any signs of the orb about?"
Barak rumbled as he stowed his bearskin cloak and helmet in one of the packs.
A hint or two. I'd guess that Zidar went through here a few weeks ago."
"We don't seem to be gaining on him much," Silk said, pulling on his leather vest.
"We are holding our own, at least. Shall we go?"
They remounted and continued along the Tolnedran highway, which ran straight through the forest in the afternoon sun. After a league or so, they came to a wide place in the road where a single whitewashed stone building, low and red-roofed, stood solidly at the roadside. Several soldiers lounged indolently about, but their armor and equipment seemed less well cared for than that of the legionnaires Geryon had seen before.
"Customs station," Silk said. "Tolnedrans like to put them far enough from the border so they don't interfere with legitimate smuggling."
"These are very slovenly legionnaires," Durnik said disapprovingly.
"Oh, they're not legionnaires," Silk explained. "They're soldiers of the customs service, local troops. There is a great difference."
I can see that," Durnik said.
A soldier wearing a rusty breastplate and carrying a short spear stepped into the road and held up his hands.
"A customs inspection," he announced in a bored tone. "His Excellency will be with you in a moment or two. You can take your horses over there."
He pointed to a kind of yard at the side of the building.
"Is trouble likely?"
Mandarallan asked. The knight had removed his armor and now wore the mail suit and surcoat in which he customarily traveled.
"Oh, no," Silk said. "The customs agent will ask a few questions, and then we will bribe him and be on our way."
"Bribe?" Durnik asked.
Silk shrugged. "Of course. That's the way things are in Tolnedra. You'd better let me do the talking. I have been through all of this before."
The customs agent, a stout, balding man in a belted gown of rusty brown color, came out of the stone building, brushing crumbs from the front of his clothes.
"Oh, good afternoon," he said in a businesslike manner.
"Oh, good day, Your Excellency," Silk replied with a brief bow.
"And what have we here?" the agent asked, looking appraisingly at the packs.
"I am Radek of Boktor," Silk replied. "A Drasnian merchant. I am taking Sindarian wool to Tolhanath."
He opened the top of one of the packs and pulled out a corner of woven gray cloth.
"Your prospects are good, worthy merchant,"
the customs agent said, fingering the cloth.
"It has been a chilly winter this year, and wool is bringing a good price."
There was a brief clinking sound as several coins changed hands. The customs agent smiled then, and his manner grew more relaxed.
"I don't think we will need to open all of these packs." "You are obviously an honorable man, worthy Radek, and I would not want to delay you."
Silk bowed again.
"Is there anything I should know about the road ahead, Your Excellency?"
he asked, tying up the pack again.
"I have learned to rely on the advice of the customs service."
"The road is good," the agent said with a shrug.
"The legions, they see to that?"
"Oh, of course. Any unusual conditions anywhere?"
"It might be wise if you kept somewhat to yourselves on your way south," the stout man advised him. "There's a certain amount of political turmoil in Tolnedra just now. I'm sure, though, that if you show that you're attending strictly to business, you won't be bothered."
"Turmoil?" Silk asked, sounding a bit concerned. "I hadn't heard about that."
"It is the secession. Things are a bit stirred up at the moment."
"Is Ranborun ill?" Silk asked with surprise.
"No," the stout man said, "only old. It is a disease no one recovers from. Since he does not have a son to succeed him, the Barun dynasty hangs on his feeblest breath. The great families are already maneuvering for a position. It's all terribly expensive, of course, and we Tolnedrans get agitated where there's money involved."
Silk laughed briefly.
"Don't we all? Perhaps it might be to my advantage, then, to make a few contacts in the right quarters. Which family, would you guess, is in the best position at the moment?"
"I think we have the edge over the rest of them,"
the agent said rather smugly.
"We? The Voduvians. I am distantly related on my mother's side to the family. The Grand Duke Cador of Tolvordu was the only logical choice for the throne."
"I don't believe I know of him."
"Oh, an excellent man," the agent said expansively. "A man of force, a vigor, and insight.
If the selection were based on simple merit, Grand Duke Kedor would be given the throne by general consent. Unfortunately, the selection is in the hands of the Council of Advisors.
Oh, I see. Indeed,
the agent agreed bitterly.
You would not have believed the size of the bribes some of those men are asking for their votes, worthy Redek.
It is an opportunity that comes only once in a lifetime, I suppose, Silk said.
Oh, don't begrudge any man the right to decent, reasonable bribes,
the stout agent complained.
But some of these men on the council have gone mad with greed. No matter what position I get in the new government, it is going to take me years to recoup what I've already been obliged to contribute. It is the same all over Tanedra. Decent men are being driven to the wall by taxes and all of these emergency subscriptions. You don't dare let a list go by that does not have your name on it, and there is a new list out every day. The expense is making everyone desperate. They're killing each other in the streets of Tolanath.
Is it that bad? Silk asked.
Oh, it is worse than you can imagine, the customs man said. The Horbites don't have the kind of money it takes to conduct a political campaign, so they have started to poison off council members. We spend millions buying a vote, and the next day a man turns black in the face and falls over dead. Then we have to raise more millions to buy up his successor. They're absolutely destroying me. I don't have the right kind of nurse for politics.
That's terrible, Silk sympathized.
If Ron Barun would only die,
the Tolnedrin complained desperately.
We are in control now, but the Honoths are richer than we are. If they unite behind one candidate, they will be able to buy the throne right out from under us, and all the while Ron Barun sits in the palace doting on that little monster he calls his daughter, and with so many guards around that we cannot persuade even the bravest assassin to make an attempt on him. Sometimes I think he intends to live forever.
Patience, Excellency. The more we suffer, the greater the reward in the end. The Tolnedrin sighed.
Well, then I will be very rich some day. But I have kept you long enough, worthy Redek. I wish you godspeed and cold weather in Tolhonath to bring up the price of your wool.
Silk bowed formally, remounted his horse, and led the party a trot away from the customs station.
It's good to be back in Tolnedra again,
the weasel-faced little man said expansively once they were out of earshot.
I love the smell of deceit, corruption, and intrigue.
You're a very bad man, Silk, Barak said. This place is a cesspool.
But of course it is, Silk laughed. But it isn't dull, Barak. Tolnedra is never dull.
They approached a tidy Tolnedran village as evening fell, and stopped for the night in a solid, well-kept inn where the food was good and the beds were clean. They were up early the next morning. After breakfast, they clattered out of the inn-yard and onto the cobblestoned street in that curious silver light that comes just before the sun rises.
A proper sort of place,
Durnick said approvingly, looking around at the white stone houses with their red-tiled roofs.
Everything seems neat and orderly.
It's a reflection of the Tolnedran mind,
Mr. Wolfe explained.
They pay great attention to details.
Well, that's not an unseemly trait, Durnick observed.
Wolf was about to answer that when two brown-robed men ran out of a shadowy side street.
Look out!
The one in the rear yelled. He's gone mad! The man running in front was clutching at his head, his face contorted into an expression of unspeakable horror. Geryon's horse shied violently as the madman ran directly at him, and Geryon raised his right hand to try to push the bulging-eyed lunatic away. At the instant his hand touched the man's forehead, he felt a surge in his hand and arm, a kind of tingling, as if the arm were suddenly enormously strong, and his mind filled with a vast roaring. The madman's eyes went blank.